You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
We're very privileged this morning to have Bruce Dixon. He is the co-editor of the Black Agenda Report. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've written extensively about the response by President Obama to the crisis with the BP oil spill. Where does this stand today? How are we doing?
Well, I come down firmly in the camp of those who call this business as usual. It doesn't take much research into the history of oil drilling to find out that spills are normal. The reason why oil drilling was outlawed across most of the coast of California was that was one of the very first places that people did offshore oil drilling in the 19th century, and leaks and contamination from the offshore wells were notorious. And even then, people who made their living on the seashore with tourism and with fisheries knew that oil drilling in their vicinity would kill their trade and would kill the way that they made their living on Mother Earth. So there's been sentiment in California for banning it from the beginning. Right now, the Republican-turned-Democrat governor of the state of Florida, where I believe they have a heavy Republican majority in the legislature, is set to consider next week a complete ban on offshore drilling in state waters up to 8 miles from shore, a complete ban. And, you know, that's really the way we need to be thinking on this. The federal government and BP have worked hand in hand. Our government has essentially been the PR person for BP the entire time. The government knowingly gave us false figures, knowingly gave the public from the beginning false figures about the amount of oil that was leaking, and the government has declared no-fly zones over the areas where the oil spill is spreading across the Gulf of Mexico. The government refuses to put into effect its own requirements that workers should be protected against airborne hazards. All the people who have worked on those oil booms and who've been around the stuff report that the air around that stuff is impossible to breathe. But since the spectacle of oil cleanup workers wearing respiratory equipment would be a public admission that there's an airborne hazard, you know, and then be the basis for countless suits and countless, you know, amounts of litigation and struggle over air quality, the federal government and BP refuses to even, not to require the cleanup workers to wear respiratory equipment. It refuses to permit them to buy their own respiratory equipment or to wear donated respiratory equipment. This is just like the war on Afghanistan or the war on Iraq, except this is a war on Mother Nature, and our government has taken the wrong side on all of them, and we can't depend on anything they tell us being true.
But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the significance of this, because in the public's mind, the Obama administration has been a very responsive. There is reports of Obama taking a strong position on limiting oil drilling in Alaska, and this was a celebrated decision. So how did we reconcile what is happening behind the scenes and what the real actions of the government have been?
People are smarter than you give them credit for. And they're smarter than the corporate media gives them credit for. Why else would the Republican-dominated state legislature in the state of Florida, a notoriously conservative state, you know, be willing to ban all offshore drilling? Come on. You know, this is much like the war. People don't believe a lot of this stuff, but you will not hear any echoes of that disbelief in corporate media. You just won't hear it. You know, people, by and large, do not believe much of what the government is saying about this, and they don't believe much of what BP is saying about this. The Obama administration is kind of a special case, however, because Democrats and most especially African Americans seem completely unable to recognize inimical behavior on the part of an administration headed by a black man. Many of them just don't seem to recognize it. There was a recent study done by the Pew Center, which is highlighted on our website at www.blackagendareport.com/now, that my colleague Glenn Ford wrote, which talks about the fact that black people are doing the worst economically of any group in the nation, but they're the most optimistic about the economy. That more black people, for the first time in anyone's memory, more black people feel like the economy is moving forward than white people do. More black people think that their own situation has improved in the last 2 years than white people do, even though the actual figures belie this. We're in a situation where people's perceptions don't always jive with reality. We're in the twilight zone somewhere.
That's an important point. I did an interview with Glenn Ford, and when I asked him, I said, what is the greatest form of oppression that we face, specifically speaking about people of color, people, you know, minorities in society? His answer was very telling. He says, you know, racism is very much still an issue, but he says the greatest threat we face as a society, as a community of, you know, human being is gentrification. And yet, you know, we don't talk about that. So how does this racism feed or strengthen that pillar of impunity that which governments conduct is the business of corporate, really?
It's almost easier to ask, how doesn't it? I mean, you know, racism is a fundamental pillar of how the U.S. operates and how the U.S. political culture pulls the wool over the eyes of large sections of the public and gets them to support things that are not in their own interest. The hue and cry against immigrants and immigration is, at its base, a profoundly racist thing. I mean, make no mistake about it. It is profoundly racist. You know, when you hear people talk about illegals, you know, what you're hearing is you're hearing racism. You're hearing a mental construction that we allow in our language where Americans put their immigration law above the rights of human beings. And if the law, you know, supersedes the rights of human beings, then you can actually have illegal people. You know, and, you know, the concept of an illegal person should make us all laugh or cry, one of the two, because it's completely ridiculous. But, you know, we have succeeded in convincing much of the American population that some people are illegal. If you were born in Mexico or Guatemala or somewhere and you're here without papers, then it's illegal for you to draw breath on this side of a border. That's racism. You know, that's excluding people from the human family and then, you know, proceeding on from there. And that's what the United States is famous for, you know, popularizing this, and its politicians have long made careers out of stoking this, and now the corporate media is doing the same. But even the law as they construct it is, you know, a kind of mythical interpretation. I mean, they say, well, these European folks, they sat and they waited in line, and these other guys, they jumped the line. Well, you know what? I got friends that work on my wife's job who are from Bulgaria and from Hungary. And you know what they had to do to get here? They applied. They went through a lottery process. And 3 months later, they were on a plane to the United States. If you want to come here from Mexico and you don't have a PhD or a huge amount of assets, your wait might be 20 or 30 years. 20 or 30 years. As opposed to a white person from Bulgaria who can be here in 20 or 30 days. Come on. You know, and this is the law. And yet and still, you know, most of the American people, well, not most, but millions of them are saying, well, they should wait in line like the Bulgarians do, like our people did. I'm not sure whether they really know about that difference. Perhaps many of them don't. And if so, ignorance is really, you know, a factor in keeping people buying into these racist stereotypes, although all of them are not ignorant. Some of them are willfully ignorant, but ignorance is still important.
But I was just going to comment on what you said, the whole connection to the situated impact. You know, I mean, why do people choose to live? Why do people in Mexico want to move 50 miles into Arizona? People never ask the question. It seems to be similar landscape. Why would they want to go from one side to the other? What impact has instruments of trade like the NAFTA, the FTAA, you know, what impact did this have in the forceful displacement of people that then are forced to move to survive, really?
Well, the actual explanations are not news to your audience, I'm sure. Your audience is well aware of the fact that NAFTA and, you know, the bilateral trade relations between, you know, the unequal trade relations between the U.S. and Mexico and the U.S. and Central America have driven people off their land. And those people went to the cities to find jobs that mostly weren't there. And so they had to keep walking here, you know, and they have to do this because they've got families to feed. It's just that simple. But the question is, how do you educate ordinary Americans on how this works? And do these ordinary Americans even want to be educated, or are they just more comfortable in their racism? Those are questions. As for how, you know, there's a lock on the mainstream media. And the craft of journalism, as we used to know it in the United States, and as it is still known in much of the world, is almost completely dead in the United States. That's one of the things that makes, you know, these perversions of reality so possible, is that we don't have adversarial, regular journalism the way they have in Nigeria, for instance, or in Europe, or even in Mexico. You just don't have that stuff. Most really democratic countries in the world actually subsidize journalism as a public good. The United States does not. And our corporate media have decided that we don't need news here in the United States. And I don't know how it is in Canada, but here in the U.S., local newspapers are dying. Local TV stations cover crime. And every half an hour news broadcast gets 7 or 8 minutes of weather. 7 or 8 minutes. It takes 7 or 8 minutes for them to tell you what temperature is, it is, and whether it's going to rain or snow tomorrow. Come on.
I guess when we look at the real impact of these instruments and whether they are the media, as you pointed out, the environment is also has been utilized as a way to divide people, where we can say the U.S. doesn't have to sign the Kyoto Agreement because China is polluting, without looking at the real per capita footprint of the Chinese people compared to that of the U.S. or Canadian citizen. On April 1st, you reported on the Environmental Protection Agency establishing new rules to restrict greenhouse emissions from cars and trucks that was supposed to be starting in 2012. Talk a little bit about the response and how this connects to the way in which this circular argument goes along. You know, I mean, that prevents us from really seeing any transformative change.
We did run an article, I believe an audio piece by a fellow named George Monbiot that coincided with the Copenhagen gathering. And in it, he had the most perceptive thing that I've ever seen. In it, what George said is, he says that every government, at least all the Western governments, have departments of the environment. And what they do is they churn out things that, you know, you should do, conservation schemes and all the rest of this. But they also have other departments, and the other departments are built around maximizing the consumption and the production of fossil fuels. So you and compared to the departments of the environment, the departments that you know, are about maximizing the, you know, the mining and the production and the distribution of fossil fuels, they take up many, many, many times the budgetary footprints of those same governments' environmental organizations. We all know that if the climate, if the general temperature of the globe rises 2 degrees Celsius in the near future, then we'll probably lose complete control. We'll be on an escalator that goes God knows where. So if the Copenhagen climate summit had been about anything, the only way that it could have been about anything fruitful would have been for it to have been in the business of identifying deposits of coal and oil and other fossil fuels that are still in the ground and declaring that those would be left there. It's past the point where conservation can save us.
Why is it that we continue to uphold structures that act against our own interests as citizens, as people?
We don't uphold them. The authorities uphold them. The state upholds them. The rich and powerful uphold them. We don't do that any more than we make war on Afghanistan. You're a Canadian citizen, I guess. Did you choose to go to war in Afghanistan? Did they ask you about it?
That's the part I'm curious about, right? Because presumably we elect governments, presumably that we have, and if not, why aren't we changing? Like I look at South America, I think of Bolivia, I think of Venezuela. The people there realize that that form of government wasn't working for them, so they've sought to change it. They're moving to transform that society in a very direct and qualitative way. You know, the oil belongs to the people. It's not going to be some, you know, foreign corporation that's going to come in here. And so I'm trying to understand, you know, at what point do you see the catalyst of transformation take place? I mean, have we become too adjusted?
The answer is, I don't know what it'll take here. Obviously, it's a bit more difficult here to do than it is in some of those other places. You know, there's more obstacles in the way, and it's just harder. And what we have to do is we have to develop a culture of struggle that, you know, lets us sustain an effort even when it looks like it might be hopeless, even when it looks like we might not live to see anything like the desired result. You know, because we're going to be defeated again and again and again before we win anything. So I don't know exactly what it's going to take. I mean, I could talk about what I'm doing here in Georgia, but the important thing is to do something and to develop a culture that holds up struggle as a virtue, whether we win or not. And eventually, hopefully, we will win. I'm also a member of a coalition called Move to Amend that you can find at www.movetoamend.org that seeks to fundamentally amend the Constitution and transform U.S. law and the U.S. legal system, because right now the U.S. legal system facilitates basically government by corporations. The example that I like to use is that if the year was 1808, if you turn the clock back, I don't know, 200 years, and it's 1810, and you're a white man that lands a cargo of slaves at Charleston, Virginia, the U.S. law and precedent and custom gives you the power of life or death over those slaves, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. Well, right now, the power of life and death over our economy and over our fortunes and our lives and our families belongs to a tiny number of people who masquerade under the legal shield of corporations. And these corporations have rights that you and I as human beings and human citizens do not have. They are immortal, for one thing. I'm 60 years old this year, and I don't have anywhere near the energy that I had 15 years ago. But BP is, what, almost 100 years old now, 120 years old now. And it's still got more vigor than any one of us does, doesn't it? You see. And, you know, so individuals can lose their assets and have their assets taxed in any number of ways, whereas the corporate elite has engineered laws that protect their assets and protect them from taxation in ways that regular humans are taxed. And of course, they've gained control. They've gained direct control over government and over the so-called governmental regulatory agencies. Actually, we have corporate rule here in the United States and in Canada. Just as surely as 600 years ago, you had rule by a landed nobility and a landed gentry. Now you've got rule by corporations, and we need to transition from rule by by and for corporations to rule by and for human beings.
So in creating that cultural struggle that you're describing, how do you keep yourself energized when you feel overwhelmed by the struggle ahead, by the obstacles?
Well, each of us is going to have different answers depending on who and where we are. So I'm afraid there isn't any answer I can give that would be universally correct. But the point is that we have to develop that spirit, and we have to develop that culture. It has existed in other times and other places, and it's going to have to be brought into existence here in North America, for Americans, for North Americans, for Canadians, for Mexicans, and for everybody else, because a culture of struggle is really the only culture of well-founded hope. So we really don't have any choice. We have to bring this into existence. And the ways we do it are going to be different depending on who and where we are and what sort of struggle we're engaged in. But it's a task that we've just all got to take on.
For people who are interested in joining your Move to Amend, how can they get information?
It's a coalition. What you can do is you can visit the Move to Amend website at www.movetoamend.org and sign the pledge. If you're interested in helping form a Move to Amend chapter or coalition, in your state and in your city, there's resources on the website that will allow you to get a hold of us, and we'll be able to supply you with some materials and some advice. Right now, they've got two guys who are walking across the country, the Monahan brothers, who are walking across the country trying to, demonstrate the injustice of corporate rule. And probably sometime this winter, we're going to see if we can engineer some kind of tour through the Black Belt of the United States, the South, from East Texas and Louisiana to either to North Florida or to Savannah, Georgia, where we can talk about this in the specific context of the way African Americans live, because up to half the African American population in the United States still lives in the South, and they're concentrated in what we call the Black Belt, a stretch from East Texas to North Florida and up the East Coast through South Carolina and Virginia. And so, there are some very, very specific things that we can talk about to an audience like that, like, for instance, the increasing corporate privatization of government functions, including the prisons, and including the roads and highways. Here in the Atlanta area where I live, they've just sold one of the main interstate highways through the middle of town. They just sold the express lanes of that highway to a private corporation. So people accustomed to using the express lanes to get to work or get to school are now going to have to pay a toll to a private corporation, even though this highway has been built and maintained for the last 30 years with public money. So what we're seeing is a wholesale transfer of public resources, publicly built, publicly maintained resources, including the public schools, into private hands. And, we think that this is going to come out to be a key issue in a lot of places. And the only reason that it has not been a galvanizing issue across many, many, many communities is that we have no local journalism in the United States, so that when horrible privatization schemes come to light and crash and burn in one town, the people in the next town or county or state don't know about it. And so the same companies get to creep next door and try the same scam again. I don't know what the situation for journalism is in Canada or in BC in particular, but these are things that have never made the media here. I mean, I'm aware that part of the impetus for the struggle in Bolivia was when they literally sold the rivers and the right to collect rainwater, to Bechtel and a handful of other American corporations. And that so outraged people in Bolivia that they took to the streets and brought the government to a halt. But no mention of that ever happened here in the United States. Maybe there were mentions of the general strike, but there was no mention of the fact that this was brought on by American corporations which owned the rivers.
But I think it's so important, as you say, that we as independent media, that we share these stories, because whatever is happening in my community is bound to come to yours. Or maybe it's already happened in your community, and we can learn from each other and how our struggles perhaps can interact. Vandana Shiva says, the corporations are one. We need to be one. The people need to be one. So,
but we need to be realistic, though, about the reach of independent media and the fact that it only reaches a tiny fraction of the people we need to talk to, okay? And we've got to get creative here and inventive, and we've got to struggle for a piece of the big media pie and make that a political issue. We've got to struggle for a piece of the big media pie that's not so-called alternative media. And we've also got to find ways to build information-sharing networks that are not dependent on corporate media. If we cannot do that, we will not be able to sustain this kind of struggle that we need. And ask me how to do that, I ain't got no idea right now, but clearly it's something that's got to be done.
I totally agree with you. And what we really need to do is make sure that our voices are heard. And I don't think that our voices are going to be heard unless we are present, you know, every day, not just on voting day, but every day, struggling to make this a reality. And, you know, just like independent media was never something that was given to us, but rather something that we had to struggle for and fight for the right to exist. So I think we can also have a big piece of that media pie that you describe.
Well, that remains to be seen.
Well, I think a good start is for people to support media like yours. So tell our audience how they can get in touch and how they can access Black Agenda Report.
Well, Black Agenda Report is on the web at www.blackagendareport.com. We do accept donations. We are entirely supported by our readers, and we're one of many places that tell stories that you don't see at all in the corporate media, and that you don't really even see that often on the web. And to check it out, just visit us at www.blackagendareport.com.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Bruce Dixon. He is the co-editor of Black Agenda Report. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take care.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.